Love how dramatic they make it.
Do they do this in Orthodoxy, Jay? You guys have magic hands? Magic hands are good.
Yes. Move over, Benny Hinn. There's a young stud in town. Right?
We like to get Jay Dyer on from time to time. He's the leader of American Byzantianity. And that's it.
I'm your resident heretic.
My friend Antonius calls it Byzantianity. It's pretty funny. But no, dude, you tweeted something out the other day. It was like a video of like some weird occult thing, and you were like, "This is really gaining traction." Do you? I should have talked to you about this beforehand. But I pulled a couple of videos of just this weird, like Jim Brewer had this guy on the other day, and everybody's passing around the clip where they talk about Chappelle. And Brewer's like, you know, they cloned Chappelle, essentially, is what it sounds like that's what he's suggesting. He's suggesting that Chappelle got a talk from a group of people, and then he disappeared and went to Africa. And then when he came back, he was a totally different person, and he got jacked and all this stuff. And he sounds like he was suggesting that the guy got cloned. And I figured you were probably the right person to talk about this, because I hear about this kind of stuff a lot with celebrities getting cloned. Is there anything to this?
I don't believe in celebrity cloning. I mean, the closest thing maybe to that would be that, you know, there have been body doubles for famous people. You know what I mean? Like, we've seen presidents and world leaders have body doubles. That's well,
like Putin. Putin's got one. I know that
they did. There was two Bin Ladens. There was a. They made a movie about Saddam Hussein's body double. Do you remember that? There's all.
Yeah, I do
remember that.
So, I mean, that seems likely in some cases if you're a superstar, like, you know, maybe Tom Coombe has a body double, but to me, it looks like, you know, people age, they get plastic surgery. You know, maybe they're on drugs and they get, I'm not talking about Chappelle, but I'm saying like people get on drugs and their appearance changes. Yeah,
I saw a new Kim Kardashian came out today. Somebody posted a video of the new Kim Kardashian. She just looks like she got a bunch of plastic surgery. Yeah. She looks like a bit of an alien. These people are demented.
I'm a skeptic on cloning too. Like, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it's even
supposed to convince me that there is cloning? Like the fact that somebody says that Dolly is a clone sheep. Well, I have no way to verify that. And they'll say that a clone is, I mean, they could just, I mean, science lies all the time anyway, right? Mainstream science. Yeah. So
yeah, we got a few things we could cover. So yeah. So that Brewer has that guy on and everybody's passing that clip around, but the majority of the interview was this insane nonsense that this guy was talking about. And it had to do with like etymology and stuff. Rob, let's play the TikTok video first.
I hate that.
And then we'll get into it. The guy's name is like 777 Truth or something, but it's so absurd. And I have no idea where the hell this stuff came from. It seems just total Gnostic nonsense. I don't know.
Glory be to God. Welcome. Hell come to evil. Illusion, love illusion. To go backwards would be to devil illusion, devolve, hence to develop.
To devolve
the mercies.
What does that mean?
Satan. That's a state in a station. That's Seth in.
That's Ethereum. That's God of five chaos Ethereum.
To Seth? The chaos.
Eth?
Theory.
Five Eth.
Dude, you could do this.
Heck yeah, man.
Like, you could literally do this. Action.
Everybody can do it.
That's the dragon of Eaton. Aten. If you're eating, Aten. He ate the split.
Like, he's just making things up. I don't get
the word for this.
Talking butterfly effect, affection. Talking.
You want the other minute of this, Anton?
No. You can do it. What is this?
Like, there's a word for this. It's called schizophrenia.
Yes.
This is how schizos think. I just covered this in. If you read through The Looking Glass, the Lewis Carroll novel, we just did a breakdown of the whole book. There's a lot of wordplay. And in Wonderland or in the Looking Glass world, everything has this sort of weird reality when you play these word games. So when Alice talks about, you know, portmanteaus or these weird, you know, double entendres or words having different senses, it like makes it real and through the Looking Glass world. So basically these people are thinking the way that you know, like they're in Looking Glass world.
This guy, okay, so Brewer is an interesting guy because a couple months ago he comes out and he starts talking against like the COVID restrictions and stuff. And he starts talking about God a little bit. And he talks about how God saved his marriage, his wife's, you know, born again Christian. But he starts hinting that, like, you know, my wife's a little crazy with this Jesus stuff. I don't really know. And now he kind of talks about God in this esoteric Gnostic way. And so if you actually go to the Brewer clip, Rob, you can see, like, this stuff is picking up some kind of like steam. It just seems like, just do the one with actual Brewer there. Yeah, yeah. But it seems to me like everybody, like the Enlightenment's coming to an end. People can see that there's something more to stuff, but they want some kind of spirituality, but anything that doesn't put any moral demands on them. Like, it's just anything but Christianity, like real Christianity, not, you know, I believe in Jesus and I have to not worry about my sins anymore because, you know, there's no responsibility with being a Christian. Just believe in faith alone. So yeah, let's just jump to the Brewer clip real quick and just see where he goes with it.
This other slavery, these other words, these other, you know, we need to wake up. We need to go to school. We need dress. You need to do that. Where
every single thing, and this will be hard for people to understand. You can ask me questions. Every single thing in a physical reality, whether a parallel universe, it doesn't matter how far you want to go in space and time. If it's governed by anything time, that's Saturn, Satan. If it's not Satan or Saturn, it's another word they're using. It's just time. Time consumes everything. I don't care about nobody's opinion. After time, you have a spirit. The spirit lives forever. That's God. So everything that's physical came from fallen angels, point blank, period. So we are created from fallen angels. There's a hierarchy that they came stuff. From, and they physically cut off a DNA strand to fall down. It's not like they're up or down. It's within the. It's within.
So is this Kabbalah? No
directions. They've cut off a DNA strand. I think they have literally fallen.
So Kabbalah is influenced by Gnosticism. So the if you read Gershom Scholem's book, he says that really Kabbalah is just a way to repackage Gnosticism for Judaic mysticism. So they're kind of the same. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, this is just straight up Gnostic stuff. So I think the conspiracy world, there's always that danger where you start to question things and then you question everything. So because you're lied to, right, you then think, well, maybe I'm lied to about everything. And then maybe everything is a lie. And so maybe reality itself is a lie. And then you're at the point of like, this whole world is an illusion. I was made by an archon. You know, it kind of goes off into the David Icke worldview, which is Gnostic.
It's kind of everywhere. You see even the symbolism in the rainbow movement, everything, like they're trying to use language for trans, like it's like trans is sacred, things like that. Like, you just see religion popping up everywhere. But it's with the collapse of Christianity and civilization, I don't know what comes next. Like, what do you think happens with this election this year?
I have no idea. I mean, I think that they're going to, I think last time we were talking about them throwing out all the stops to derail things. You know, we talked about, I think, that Obama produced movie.
Yeah.
Leave the World Behind, which, you know, has a scenario of something apocalyptic. I just went and saw the new Alex Garland movie Civil War, which is not at all what you think it is. You think it's a movie about an actual, you know, apocalyptic scenario in America, like the Obama movie. It's not that at all. It's very bizarre. It's more of an art house film, which is not what the trailer makes you think it is. But nevertheless, it's still very much about this theme of the end of America, the end of this nation, this civilization. So for whatever reason, they really want to keep perpetuating this notion of the end of an aeon, the end of an era, probably to help transition us into, you know, the next phase of the Great Reset or whatever. So I don't know, like, what,
but it does feel like we're coming to the end of something, right? Yeah. I mean, it definitely has that feel to it. And even the flooding of migrants thing and the allusions to war, kind of like this fog of war stuff that's going on, these little kind of just the seeds they've been planting over the last few years. It just, and then on top of that, I still don't understand people who are so convinced 2020 was stolen, but think that this election is going to work out okay. I don't get that.
Yeah, Roger Stone had a good article back in 2016 about the specific strategies and even like some of the people involved in foreign CIA operations and coups, how they would rig elections, and pointing out that they were involved in his view at that time. So, yeah, I mean, they, I'm sure they're going to pull out all the stops. You know, I think it wasn't even Dr. Phil talking about a new pandemic. So, I mean, it's getting so crazy that, you know, Dr. Phil, get ready for a new pandemic. Y'all need to be prepared. So, I mean, we're at Dr. Phil's now, Alex Jones level stuff. So,
well, what's funny about Dr. Phil is that because conservatives are so cringe, man. It's like, this is a guy who's essentially a leftist his whole life, and then all of a sudden he comes out and he says something against transgenderism, and then you have the whole conservative world holding this guy up. Look, Dr. Phil is our new conservative.
They do it with Bill Maher too, right? They do
Bill Maher too. Bill Maher.
Yeah.
Which is so bizarre to me, man. Like, so when you're all right, so you still do the fourth hour on Alex Jones, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about planning that?
Like, I don't topics? Plan it. I never do.
You really just go on and wing it.
Now you just gave Anthony more no, ammo to not
you
plan.
You can ask Jamie. She's always like, "What are you going to talk about?" And I'm like, "I don't know." She'd be asking me like 5 minutes before, and I'm like, "I'm not sure yet." So I kind of just like I'll bat around a few ideas in my head, and then I'll just spit it out. I'm dead serious.
We had Trent Horn and Joshua Charles on the other night. We were talking about transhumanism, and we were just talking about like the way technology has been kind of almost. Josh was saying he thinks transhumanism is almost inevitable because of the trends that are going. Like we know they keep telling us it's going to happen, but how do you think this whole thing's going to unfold? Like,
yeah, I mean, well. That's interesting because I mean, that sounds a little too conspiratorial for Trent. Trent tends to, I think, shy away from anything perceived as conspiratorial. So I didn't get to see y'all's show. I'm curious what his comments were. But and then I guess on top of that, the question would be, you know, what exactly counts? Because transhumanists always say, don't you like wearing spectacles? Isn't that just transhumanism? Well, that's different than significant modifications to the human being. Okay, so wearing glasses or even having a prosthetic arm, and there's nothing wrong with those things.
That's but the problem is something disordered.
Yeah, and then they'll go for they'll leap from that to say, well, then therefore, they'll talk about the plasticity of the human of humanity. Man is not a real. There's no essential. Nature, there's no essences, so man is just sort of silly putty that can be molded into whatever. And I think that's the presupposition of most of the transhumanists is that there's no such thing as man, there's no such thing as essences or substances. So man can evolve into, you know, some sort of cyborg or some sort of hybrid. And ultimately, transhumanism is Gnostic, going back to the conspiracy idiots that we were talking about. I'm not talking about Jim Brewer. I like Jim Brewer because. We've actually had a few DMs. I'm trying to get him to do a podcast.
I like him too.
Maybe I can talk him out of the Gnostic stuff, right?
But, this was the first show I saw because I always thought, I mean, he's been on several shows where he talked about God. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is awesome. You know, like hearing somebody talk about God. Then he had this guy on and I'm like, what the hell is this?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? With the conspiracy world can always tip over into, you know, Gnostic stuff, typically with fallacies. And if you think about what fallacies, I've been talking about this a lot lately. We'll go back to the transhumanist, which is basically just Gnostic. I mean, ultimately, the transhumanist, to put a cap on that, is the idea that we're going to transcend the body and sort of be in the cloud or whatever. That's totally Gnostic. So we're right back at Gnosticism with the end goal of most transhumanists. But the Gnostic stuff with in terms of like the word concept fallacy or whatever, they're always playing these word games. Like, do you know Jordan Maxwell is? A lot of this comes from him.
No.
So he was a really popular last generation boomer conspiracy theory dude, really popular in the 80s and 90s. And his whole thing was a lot of these word games and wordplay, right? So he would have these lectures where he'd say, and he talks like this, and he says, if you understand Admiralty law, you're raised under Admiralty law, and you are like the birth of a ship because your mother gives birth to you. A ship is in water. You come out of your mother's womb through water. Therefore, you are owned by the state. He was always playing these word games. And all the conspiracy theorists like that dude, the younger, they're just mimicking him. So he's like the granddaddy of this ridiculous word concept fallacy. Give me one more example. There was a dude who came on to debate. this was one of the wildest ones that I've seen yet. And it has to do with lack of education. So the big part of what's going on, you're talking about this collapse, people making these ridiculous mistakes. It's not having basic education that, remember, through the looking glass, that's like kids reading.
Yeah.
This is books that kids are supposed to read with wordplay. There's actually quite a bit of sophisticated logic and, you know, grammar and predicate subject. There's lessons in the book. That's the purpose of it in Victorian England, you know, the pedagogy at that time. And so you've got people who don't know any of this. And this guy came on the stream and he was trying to debate and he said, I've written a whole book and I figured out the solution. Everybody in the West is worshiping a demon. And I'm like, how could everybody in the West? He says, because you worship God. I'm like, well, God's not a demon. How can we all be worshiping a demon? He says, because if you look in Isaiah, it says one of the demons called fortune is God, G-A-D. He says, what does that sound like? God, we're all worshiping the demon God. And I'm like, first of all, an A and an O are different. And, you know, that's an English transliteration. God is from Theos. And that has nothing to do with Gad, a demon. And so they literally think that like the phonetics is words that like casting a spell. So,
well, that brings us to the title of the video. You must call him Yeshua. Like, yeah, exactly. What is that whole thing? Is that just Messianic Jews who are, I don't understand, because every once in a while you'll come across somebody on Twitter and they'll use Yeshua and come down on you for using the Greek or the Roman pronunciation of Jesus.
Yeah, it's a kind of a superstition, I think. There was a rising popularity in the late 1800s, early 1900s of what would become the Hebrew Roots movement. So what you're talking about that's flourished and kind of influenced all these different sects, whether it's so Bryson is not Black Hebrew Israelite. He's Hebrew Roots. So he's an Aryan. He doesn't actually have a group. He says he's part of some group that I don't think has any like meeting place. But he's an Aryan Hebrew Roots person who is not Black Hebrew Israelite. Black Hebrew Israelite is another, its own weird thing, but they all relate back to this thing you're talking about with, we've got to use the name Yeshua. And it's a weird, just superstitious thing that began, you know, kind of late 1800s. With some of these people thinking that the purest form of Christianity must be, you know, before the church expanded to the Gentiles, it must be like Acts 1 to 10, right? Because once Cornelius came in, it started getting too Gentile, right? So if we go back to that pure Judaic era of the church, which is a real fundamental misunderstanding of redemptive history. I mean, there's important things that happen after Acts 10, right?
Yeah, I mean, Acts 15, the Judaism. Acts 15, the Judaizers coming in, yeah, right?
Exactly, and
the whole like settling of
Judaizing
that.
As a cult, for example, yeah. Or apostasy. So it's a really fundamental, weird misunderstanding too. It's kind of like, you know, Protestants thought, for example, the Reformation, we're going to get back to the pure church. We'll go back to, you know, the first, second, Pentecost. Third pure Christianity before all the accretions like Gavin Ortland talks about, right? Well, I think this is a variation of that where they thought, well, if we want to be true Protestants to get back to the pure church, we got to go back to like, you know, Acts 2 and Pentecost and, you know, preaching and talking, you know, in Hebrew or Aramaic or whatever they think they're talking. Anyway, yeah, it's just kind of a superstitious thing. I think that, I mean, the Old Testament says many, many times over that the covenant would be open to the Gentiles. Isaiah says there will be Gentile priests.
Yeah.
But I think these people have no conception of any of that.
Yeah. Malachi, it says a pure offering will be offered throughout the world, things like that. There's a whole bunch of places like that. What does Bryson Gray actually belong to a sect, or is he just grabbing the Bible, reading it for like, because I was arguing with somebody the other day and I said, Sola Scriptura is probably the most evil heresy to ever come out of church history because it really made
Yeah.
Nothing else fractured the church more than that. It made it so that there wasn't just a sect came about. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of sects. Everybody grabs the Bible, they read it for themselves, and they interpret it how they want, and they call each other heretics. The only thing they all agree on is that the traditional forms of Christianity are wrong, and that's it.
I would agree. I think if you tried to pick out the root error, and it's odd too, because in the Trent Horn debate with James White, he got James White to admit that they weren't operating on the principle of sola scriptura for the first four centuries or whatever he admitted. That seems like an odd admission for a person that's been arguing for sola scriptura for so long. It was a great admission. I'm glad he admitted that. But I think that speaks to your point that, yeah, even before errors like sola fide or errors, you know, relating to whatever else you want to point out in the Reformation, iconoclasm or whatever, there's a more fundamental error of thinking that, you know, the limitation of revelation is only to this arbitrary written collection of Protestant decided texts, right? Yeah. And then there's another assumption I think goes along with that that we often miss, which is the assumption that texts are self-interpreting. No. I mean, why do you think the Constitution has a Supreme Court to interpret it, to enforce an interpretation, right? It doesn't make sense to think of texts, and this is always what Protestants say, you know, even James White says stuff like, well, they talk about the perspicuity of Scripture, and there might be some verses that are perspicuous or clear, but there's many that aren't. And the Scriptures themselves even say, Peter says, Paul has written many things that are difficult to understand at the ignorant, unstable twist. So clearly not all the Scriptures are clear. And the idea that the texts say what they mean and mean what they say is a really naive, kind of dumb view of how interpretation and texts work.
Especially because people operating under that whole presupposition, none of them really use typology ever. Exactly. None of them ever see Jesus as the new Moses. None of them ever really see, you know, the unfolding of covenants throughout Scripture. It's all just a paradigm of taking about six or seven verses from Scripture that all have to do with penal substitution and being saved by grace through faith, and they add the word alone into it, and then you wind up just getting this fracturing where, as long as what they'll call fundamentals, which are kind of ridiculous because I don't even think any of them agree on what the fundamentals are. It's a weird thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
No. If you got to jump in, go ahead.
Yeah, I totally agree there. I think I remember when I was a Protestant encountering this issue. I was studying at Bonson Seminary, and I took a hermeneutics class, and Bonson was teaching hermeneutics and eisegesis, and he was always stressing the grammatical, historical, literal level. And there was a controversy that was happening at that time in the Reformed world between him and a guy named James Jordan, and some other people who were stressing that, hey, wait a minute, the traditional interpretation of the church fathers isn't limited to and doesn't only focus on the grammatical historical sense of the text. And they were moving towards typology, moving towards allegory, moving towards anagogy, all the different things that we call, you know, the four senses, right? So James Jordan wrote these books that the other Reformed people were getting mad about. And I was moving more and more in that direction of typology back at that time. And so it ended up being kind of a thing we had a falling out over in terms of the Bonson circles. And this, you know, to me over time, it became really clear that, well, wait a minute, if you look at the New Testament, the way the apostles interpret the Old Testament, they're the ones constantly doing typology. So that's the apostolic hermeneutical lens is Christology.
You see Peter referencing the flood, talking about baptism. You see Paul calling Christ the new Adam. Like, you really do see them constantly explaining Scripture in that way.
And I brought this up to a couple of the Protestant professors I had, and their response at that time was something like, oh, and this is what Protestants, especially Reformed Protestants, they always do this. They'll say, oh, well, those are the only cases that you can do it because the apostles are limiting you in their examples. So in other words, they're not
Someone said that to me. So, man, it's so frustrating sometimes because I was showing some, I'm like, okay, he's telling me, no, the Bible. I'm like, okay, well, the Bible actually tells us how you solve disputes in the church. when you just look at Acts 15, you see the Council of Jerusalem is called. So you obviously call a council, and that is how you solve these disputes. And this is what happens in the early church. And that's how you get some of these different things. Well, no, we didn't have the canon of scripture was still being written at that time, but now that's the sole rule of faith. I'm like, where does it say that in the Bible?
It's amazing. Where does the Bible say, by the way, that the only uses of typology are the specific ones used by the apostles in the New Testament? It's arbitrary.
Yeah,
it doesn't say that. So they're always interjecting sort of arbitrary rules. And to bring it up to the Reformation, it actually mirrors what happened in the Reformation with the dispute that I had with one of the professors at the time. Because if you look at the way that the humanist movement, which was influencing both Protestants and Catholics, so that is, in itself, that's not a bad thing. I'm not talking about secular humanism. Humanism was a movement to go back to the original sources of the Greek and the Latin. It's very popular amongst people like Erasmus and John Calvin, other reformers. So it was a Catholic and Protestant academic movement. But when the reformers took on the humanist move, they decided, well, this means when we go back to the original Greek Hebrew text or whatever, we're going to stress the grammatical historical level of interpretation and not do any of the other typological stuff. So they arbitrarily limited their approach because sometimes the Catholic opponents or the interlocutors of the Protestants would appeal to typology. So this, they saw this as a way to sort of cut off any typological argumentation. And you can see it, for example, if you read the debate between Eck and Luther, which is a great debate, this actually comes up, the typology and this kind of stuff. And Luther, who does, he's more typological than Calvin, but, you know, he says something like, well, I just don't accept any of your typology arguments. So
it's weird because for me, Christianity didn't become real until I saw typology. It's like when the Bible came alive for me when I started seeing it was like, this story is so complex that it could never have been written by a human mind like that.
Typology proves that. I wrote an essay some years back. I'm sorry, I meant to cut you off. Just pointing out that typology actually isn't apologetic.
100%.
I did an article on that. Yeah.
So, guys, what we're going to start doing is we're going to start getting into some. All right. We're not going to debate because I honestly don't. I've never looked into orthodoxy enough to even know the orthodox arguments against Catholicism. I'm just a freaking Roman Catholic. Like, I'm, that's just my DNA. But you and I got into, not that we didn't get into something. I called Mary the mediatrix of all graces the other day. Now, that's not a Catholic dogma. But you called me out and said, would she be the mediatrix of all graces before the incarnation? And at first I was like, well, maybe they're post-incarnation, but no, like all grace. It's really like when we have Father Maudsley on, it's like, it's crucifixion to creation, not creation to crucifixion. Like the crucifixion was the original plan. It's not like the crucifixion was a plan B. So would you, as an Orthodox, have an issue calling Mary the mediatrix of all graces? In theory, not as dogma or anything like that. Like,
well, first thing I would say is, I don't know if I would say the crucifixion was the plan per se, because I think the incarnation was always the plan. And this is the view that you see in the Eastern Fathers. They always stress this idea that, Adam being created in the garden is created, yes, in the image of the Trinity, but also specifically in the image of Christ. And so Adam is the reason Adam is a Christological type in 1 Corinthians 15 is because he's made in the image of Christ, the Logos, in the garden. So for us, that kind of assumes that creation itself is Christological. It's a theophany. It's a Christophany for us as Orthodox. And that's in the Roman Catholic world, Franciscans and maybe Scotus, but Franciscans are pretty much on the same page with the Eastern Church on that perspective of the incarnation not being a plan B. I would say in God's foreknowledge, yes, he certainly foreknew that the Lamb would be slain before the foundation of the world, but I wouldn't include the necessarily evil or anything like that under the divine decree. That would be moving in the direction of Calvinism. I know you're not saying that, so I wanted to be clear about specificity about that the incarnation was always the plan, because we think it was always the plan to deify man. Even had there not been a fall, God still would have been wanting to raise man up to greater and greater heights, so to speak.
So you guys would call that theosis. We would probably call that divinization.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. One difference there would be that we believe that it's kind of a never ending up into God. I don't know if the
Roman we would say the beatific vision or something.
Yeah,
or...
but anyway, so I don't know that the phrase itself, because I mean, if she's the new Eve, which she is, Saint Irenaeus says that she's the new Eve. She acquiesces where Eve failed, so she's the new Eve. Yeah, in that sense, I think you could say that. In immediate sense, not M-E-D-I-A-T, immediate sense, she is in that sense.
People get hung up on the phrase mediator, right? Because there's one mediator between God and man. But God comes to us through her. So in a very real sense, she is a mediator between God and man. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, it just in a logical sense. Like, God comes to us through her, so she mediates humanity and God.
Yeah, and if you mean it in that sense, I don't think there's a problem necessarily. I just wanted to raise some interesting thoughts about whether, more so that maybe this would be a problem for a Thomist, because in a Thomist position, there was debates in the Middle Ages that, you know, could God incarnate as an animal? Could the incarnation be effective or effectual if God didn't assume human nature? Could it happen through some other means? And that was a dispute that was had, I think, with Franciscans. And the Franciscans were affirming the Eastern position that no, God had to take on human nature, because that was the only way that would heal human nature. So that's a medieval dispute, but it illustrates the point that that the world is a Christophany or a theophany for us. And I don't think in Thomism, I mean, you have this idea of the analogy of being. I just don't think it really ends up being, in the immediate sense, something Christological. So that's the big difference that I was
It's interesting talking about this, because you know the Catholic arguments, because you went through a Catholic phase, you know? So you actually, like, I'm a high school dropout. I never read, like, Thomism.
Well, I mean, you know quite a bit, so you're not doing your position, you know, you're not failing to do it justice.
That's the only thing I worry about. Like, I'm not a theologian or anything. So I don't want to have people come on, hear me debate you, and then be like, oh, you know, I'm not the guy for that.
I think, what you were talking about with Mary, you know, the terms that are often used is mediate salvation versus immediate salvation. So mediate being the, you know, if I am your friend and you're an unbeliever and, you know, we're buddies for a long time and I pray for you and, you know, we hang out and I eventually convert you, then I saved you. Right. Yeah. Paul speaks this way, right, where he says, you know, to Timothy, do this and you will save those around you. And Protestants, you know, oh, does that mean you think Jesus doesn't save you? Mary saves you? No, it's like there's a cooperation going on with God being the ultimate right source of salvation, but using these proximate means to save us. So. It's just, I would say that, you know, in the liturgical tradition that we have, I'm not aware of a phrase of something like that for Mary, because we do differ on Mary, the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic.
Well, okay. So the Marian dogmas, maybe we could talk about those a little bit.
What's the difference between the Dormition and the Assumption? Even, I mean, I know Catholics celebrate the Dormition as well, but.
For us, we would say that she was still under the effects of Adam's sin. So we don't think that she was immaculately conceived, even though we have a lot of terminology like spotless virgin. We think she was preserved from actual sin. But because we don't see original sin as anything dealing with inherent guilt, and I know that the modern Roman Catholic position doesn't hold that, but typically the Latin position has had a tendency to think that the stain of original sin in some way, is passed on. Yeah, that's a typical. I don't mean the point between your balls and your butt. I'm talking about taint in the sin.
Yeah,
I'm not talking about body parts.
Yeah, I think the modern Catholic apologetic would be more like original sin is a lacking of something, like a lacking of grace.
Yeah. I mean, that's so we would say that Mary still died because she's a daughter of Adam, but she had no actual sin. Okay, so she was preserved from actual sin by grace, but that she still died. That's the meaning of dormition, was that she went to sleep. We don't believe in the necessarily the bodily.
What about the pangs of childbirth? Is there any writings on that? Like, because Catholics will actually say it was like light passing through glass. Her hymen was kept intact.
Yeah, that's the terminology in Ezekiel 44. So we would say that she's ever virgin, because in Ezekiel 44, it says the prince passes through the gate and the door remains shut and it's never affected. So I would imagine that's the case.
It's funny because the Latin church does get super technical about a lot of things, right? Like especially after the split, the Latin church gets super technical about stuff like with Thomas Aquinas and stuff.
Both churches do, but it's sort of like different things. Like the Eastern Church is super specific on elements of Christology and that kind of stuff. And I'm not saying the Latin Church isn't, but after the split, I think the specificity on what is really precise is different. But
what are some of the things after the split that the Eastern Church does? It's weird. Like, I really think, because the Latin Church got so rigorous in their the logic of everything and like making sure everything had rationality behind it, they lost some of the mysticism a little bit. You know, it just seems like that, especially when I read things from the Eastern Fathers a little bit. Yeah. And even like the little exposure I've had to it, which isn't much, you know, granted, but it just seems like they have a much more mystical sense of things than the Latin Church.
I think that's still okay to say as kind of a basic distinction between the perspectives, but it can always be overplayed because, for example, in a lot of St. Gregory Palamas's writings, he relies heavily on Aristotelian logic. So Roman Catholics might find that or hear that and think that that's odd because, aren't you guys the mystics? Why would you be doing apodictic treatises on, you know, Aristotelian logic or whatever? But so, I mean, there's more overlap on some of that stuff than we might think, but I would say that if you pick out specific doctrines like the theophanies or the essence-energy distinction or, in what sense we participate in uncreated grace, that stuff is not typically in the Eastern Palamite synods, for example, the Byzantine synods, for example. There's not an attempt to resolve it through like syllogisms. The resolutions are typically citations of the six councils, the six councils decree, the Eastern Fathers, Cappadocians. So in other words, they're saying, look, what's the ancient faith say about theophanies? What's the Bible say about theophanies? We're not going to worry about the fact that many of the medieval Latin theologians are concerned with how it compromises divine simplicity for God to be in time and space in a theophany before the incarnation. Does that make sense? Like, for example, this just came out fairly recently. This is the translation of the all four of the Palamite synods, which we haven't had an English translation of that for a good while, maybe in parts in other books. But so this just came out, and you notice that the response of the Palamite synods in Byzantium to the Roman Catholic synods of particularly Lyons 1274 and then Florence. The Orthodox in Byzantium response is what is relating to the things I mentioned, right? So uncreated energies, rejecting Thomism specifically in terms of created grace and absolute divine simplicity, not rejecting everything in Thomism. We have people in the East that appreciated Aquinas, like St. Gennadius. But elements of Thomism that we couldn't accept would be the notion that grace is not itself uncreated. We can't accept the beatific vision in the Roman Catholic sense. Palamite synods talk about the nature, person, will, energy distinction being explicit, that you have to accept those as more than just conceptual. So those kinds of things are pretty precise.
It's funny, like the minutia that that some of the, like even the debates in the early church that you saw to like hammer out even Nestorianism and mm-hmm. and some of it's over like a single letter and a word or a phrasing and it
well homoousios homoousios is the difference between Jesus being the eternal Son of God and being the first thing God created, so yeah mm-hmm. right
yeah it's just interesting to me, like even you referencing all these councils and things like that, like to me it almost like it would take such an incredible amount of study for a Westerner, not for like, I really do think like there's something to the apostolic succession in the East and the church growing itself in the East like that. And then the Western church doing its thing in the West. So, you know, obviously somebody in the East, like that is their church. That is the church, the apostles set up. But for somebody in the West to actually have to go and dig into all these things and this kind of stuff, like, do you think that there's any, almost like God would not make his church so hard to find, a kind of thing. Yeah. I don't, you know, just for a Westerner, like it would just seem like you're somebody who goes and reads a million books, you know, like for your every common guy, you know, it just seems like a hard process to kind of hammer out.
Yeah. I understand this point, this critique or this, I don't want to call it a selling point. I mean, yeah.
Listen, first of all, anybody watching, like it, like people are allowed to have different positions. I'm asking a question. You can ask questions. It is what it is.
Yeah. I'm just saying, and I understand that objection. But at the same time, it's sort of like we could think of periods in church history where East and West were, you know, basically united, where we had similar problems. So for example, in the 4th century, much of the church was already capitulated to not so much full Arianism, but semi-Arianism.
Yeah.
So if there's St. Athanasius and a handful of bishops left, you know, would we then say, well, look, what's the basic numbers approach here, right?
Yeah.
So one big difference, I think, in approaching these questions practically between Orthodox and many Roman Catholics is just that we see Orthodoxy first and foremost as not so much numbers or expanse. It can mean that at times. It can mean, you know, in particular periods when there's union and there's an expansion of the church, large numbers. I think Catholicity does include to a degree the notion of size and numbers, but it can't be reduced or defined by that because there's many periods when the majority of the professing church is heterodox. So I think that would really speak to that. There's other periods too, by the way. There's like, you know, there's other periods when other heresies almost, you know, took over large portions of the iconoclast. You know, they captured a lot of the bishoprics. They captured a couple patriarchs, I think, at one point. So, you know, you can have pretty sizable losses, so to speak, or even the majority being heterodox. St. Maximus has a great quote where he says something to the effect of, you know, even if the true Catholics were reduced to a small number, he says, I would be amongst them and they would be the true universal church. So in that sense, we can see Catholicity can't be sort of reduced to numbers.
What do you make of, like, because I think a lot of the young kids, to me, somebody coming from atheism or Protestantism and going Orthodox or Catholic, I'm happy about. Like anything in that movement towards traditional Christianity, I'm happy about. Like, there's something so my conversations with somebody like you are extremely different than they would be with somebody who's Protestant. Like somebody who's Protestant, I'm going to be combative. I'm going to try and hammer away at their little thing. Where at least we're both coming at it, seeing, you know, the sacraments and things like that. You're like, you're actually living out a Christian, you know, the way that Christianity was intended to be lived out. What do you think of all these young kids coming in that don't have access to divine liturgy? Like I think there's a lot of young ortho bro online only ortho bros.
That is true. It's a problem. We've addressed that too, by the way. I think a lot of people think that like we encourage that or something like that. I mean, ever since our Discord started back in 2017, from day one, we had clergy in there pretty quick, and the clergy were always stressing. I've always stressed too, that you can't just be online. Like, it's not, you're LARPing if you think that it's just online. Now, if you don't have a church or, you know, that's, we had a dude that I think was in like Saudi Arabia was in the Discord at one point. Like, I mean, that guy can't.
He has to
do the best he can do. I mean, you do the best you can. I mean, I don't think God expects more of us than is possible. You know what I mean? So,
It's a weird time right now, even for Catholics, right? There's a lot of Catholics who won't attend the Novus Ordo and they have to find a Latin mass somewhere. And they're
I was going to say, like, in my experience when I was Roman Catholic, I remember, you know, I came in the Novus Ordo 2003. And I was in the Novus Ordo for maybe a year and a half. Where I came in was actually fairly conservative Novus Ordo. So it wasn't like, you know, hip hop mass or any of that stuff. Yeah. It was fairly conservative. The Novus Ordo mass was done very reverently. And that probably kept me from going to the Latin mass longer than I would have. Right. But I pretty quickly decided to. Somebody left a Latin Mass magazine in the pew one time, and I remember picking
it up. What year was this?
Sorry to read. This is 2003, four, somewhere in there. Three,
so, man, this is before some more Pontificum comes out, anything. Okay.
Yeah. I was reading Von Hildebrand. I remember reading a Dietrich Von Hildebrand article in an old Latin Mass magazine about the superiority to the Novus Ordo Missae and all that, and I didn't know anything at that time. It was all new to me, but I piqued my interest. And so then I dove down the rabbit hole, the Bunini and all that stuff. And I ended up getting like Paul Davies' trilogy. I read that right away. I read Gomaris and all the Tradcats. I read all that stuff. I read several of Lefebvre's books. So I was pretty hardcore SSPX for a good 7 or 8 years. So
that's where you would go? You're going to a chapel? Yeah,
I went to the Memphis SSPX for a long time.
Wow, that's interesting. all right, so I know you guys have like weeping icons, right? Are there Eucharistic miracles in the East?
No, interestingly, there's not. This is an interesting difference between East and West. If in the Orthodox Church, if something happens in regard to the Eucharist, they stop the liturgy.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that weird? Yeah. The reason for that, apparently, is that the belief in the East tends to be that they're concerned with the danger of prelest rather than the sort of, and I don't mean this in a derogatory sense, but sort of like jumping on the idea that, oh, it's a miracle, right? I'm not trying to cast aspersions on you guys. I'm just saying, like, that's their rationale for it.
Well, we've talked about there's a major problem with in the Catholic tradition of people prophecy chasing, right? And like just every apparition they go crazy over. There's issues with Medjugorje. There's like, you know, there's a lot of that goes on. Like Rob and I both, when we were younger, like my parents were like charismatic Catholics, you know, and growing up in that environment, it was a lot of it was chasing feelings. Mm-hmm. And you go from spiritual high to spiritual high. And then when you crash, like really crash, you know? Yeah. So finding the traditional Latin mass for me was more just like a stabilization. Yeah. Like, oh, okay. I don't have to be going and singing and dancing. And stuff
it was like sobering up.
Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, when I was a Protestant, I was, you know, pretty hardcore reformed. So we had none of that like craziness. So I was kind of already in at least some notion of a stable worship environment where you don't have any of that. All that's shunned upon, right? But you know, and I think every religious tradition can have that danger. In the Orthodox Church, that tends to be more of a danger in the monastic sphere. A lot of monastics are tempted with prophecy chasing. That's a great term. I don't know. Did you coin that? That's genius. I wouldn't say it's as, I had a decent experience of Roman Catholicism over the years. So I wouldn't say that it's as prevalent in the Orthodox world as it is in the Roman Catholic world. But the difference I think is that, in the Orthodox Church, monasticism is still very strong. And it's very prevalent, and you'll see a lot more monastics everywhere than you would in most Roman. I know that you guys have monastics and convents, but I'm saying like they're a bigger part of our church in like the day-to-day life. Like if you go to Jordanville, like Jordanville Seminary is like attached to monastic life. So they want the seminarians to actually be in a monastic cycle. So in that regard, I think the danger, I wouldn't say it's prevalent, but I would say that there's a decent sector of the Orthodox world that kind of gets stuck into this chasing. Elder so-and-so said that, you know, Antichrist will appear and will be a Furby.
I think that's a joke,
but I'm saying.
No, obviously, but I think there's something in us. I mean, I've said before, I think like every generation wants to believe they're the last because they're very uncomfortable with the world going on totally fine without the, like, I don't know if it's like a certain amount of self-importance that people feel like, no, this is the end times. But I remember even in the 90s when my parents were in the charismatic stuff, it was like, they went to Medjugorje and it was all about like bleeding statues and this is going on. And it was the end of the world. It's called Y2K is coming. The end of the world's going to come. And it, and like when it never came, that led to me leaving the sacraments for years because I was like, what the hell? Like, well, this was for nothing, you know? And it wasn't until I came back to that sobering, more stable version of, cause, and look, I know a lot of people in the comments are like, oh, charismatic Catholics are the best. I'm not saying they're not, like they're some of the most faithful people I know, but for me it didn't work. Like it was just too much of living on the edge of my seat waiting for something to happen that just wasn't coming.
When I was like, I remember when I first started reading the Bible when I was 18, I started going to just whatever Bible studies my friends were going to, and some of them were charismatic, so I had a little bit of a phase when I was 19 where I was charismatic and in like a Protestant sense. So when I became Reformed, though, that I got rid of most of that pretty quick. Yeah. So when I came into the Roman Catholic Church, I didn't really have any interest in charismatic Catholicism. I was always kind of, I thought that was kind of weird. And I'd seen enough of that nonsense in the Protestant world that I was like, this is not going to help anybody in the Catholic world. I don't know why it's here. It doesn't make any sense. And I mean, it's absolutely forbidden in the Orthodox world. I mean, it's like, Father Seraphim Rose basically completely condemns it. And so he's, you know, widely respected. And I think he expresses the, you know, Orthodox mindset that we believe there's miracles and clairvoyance and this kind of stuff, but the charismatic displays and all that, we would say it's delusion.
Yeah. I think it's people really have to be on guard for it, especially the chasing different.
Yeah.
Apparitions and stuff.
Well, it will do what you said. Like it'll give you this false hope, and then when it doesn't happen, then you feel let down. Oh man, I've been cheated. Man, screw this. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it leads to that letdown.
Yeah. What do you think of the Orthodox Catholic reunion that they're going to try and put forth next year for the what is it in 2025? They're doing that.
I don't think that it makes much sense. I mean, I think that a lot of the I think traditional Catholics would agree with Orthodox on the point that, you know, it doesn't really make sense to try to pretend that you all agree on key issues that you don't agree on. So it's a lot of words and gibberish. And I actually think there's a bigger sort of geopolitical agenda behind it. I don't really think it's about theology per se at the high power level. I think a lot of people interested in it believe it's about theology and they're sincere, but I think it's really part of this, you know, World Economic Forum, you know, internationalist agenda. I mean,
Masonic fraternity.
Yeah, exactly. It's about that kind of stuff more than it is getting to the theological truth, because a lot of these people even say, you know, that are heavily involved in ecumenism and whatnot, they even say it's not about truth. It's about all of us, you know, on the journey to find the church, as if there isn't the church. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think it's a lot of geopolitical machinations more so than it is anything to do with truth.
There was a Catholic author who wrote a book about the CIA infiltration at the Second Vatican Council.
So I know. I've been referencing it ever since it came out. I love that book.
For people who think that's not like it's even like the people elections now I worry about, because you know. I mean, if the American elections are getting messed with, what do you think is going on?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, a couple of the other Gladio books that I read and analyzed, the Paul Williams book and even one of the books written by the CIA dude Kaler, who was pro CIA involved in the Vatican, like not a conspiracy dude, like saying why it needed to happen. Even he talks about the CIA being directly involved in two of the papal enclaves, Paul VI and John Paul II. Now, he's not saying that they caused them to be elected. Yeah. Paul Williams says that they did cause them to be elected. They wanted to make sure, particularly with Paul VI, because they were worried that John the 23rd, because of the encyclical about is it Pacem in Terris, the one that deals with like the world and the economy. It's called the pink encyclical. You know what I mean? You know the one I'm talking about?
I don't know, but
yeah. So John the 23rd wrote an encyclical about it's like one of the first to call for the need for international bodies to deal with economic and social disparities. Right. Yeah. I read it many years ago. I remember all the details in it, but it's famous for that. I'm pretty sure it's Pacem in Terris. But
yeah,
that worried the CIA was worried because they thought he might have socialist leanings. So they wanted to ensure that the next pope would be on board with the Western Americanist ideas of the CIA. So it's not that they like mind control Paul VI. I'm not saying that, but they wanted Paul VI. Because they felt that he was more in line with what the CIA wanted with their neoliberal goals. So,
this isn't even crazy stuff, because you even look at all the bishops. Yeah. You look at all the bishops that Francis elevated to cardinal. It's like, these are all men that'll be easily manipulated, and who knows, what's going on behind the
scenes. Yeah. It looks like, if Paul Williams's book is correct. And I mean, even if he's only correct about 60% of it, I mean, that alone is like devastating. I mean, that's pretty wild. I mean, he basically says that Kissinger was calling a lot of these shots. That's why Kissinger and Kissinger was meeting with Paul VI constantly. Colby was meeting and talking to a lot of the James Eustace Angleton was stationed in Rome. He was like the CIA section chief in Rome. He was the liaison office between CIA and the Vatican for a long time. And then one other character, John Paul II, he constantly met with so there was all these there was a bunch of Roman Catholic CIA dudes under Reagan. Colby, so he called them his Templars or something like that. Anyway, I'm serious. And they were just really trying to sway the Vatican away from, which sounds good on the surface, right? This is Wim Hof's point, right? He makes the point that it makes sense to sway the Vatican away from like any alliances with Gorbachev or any alliances with the Soviets. The problem is that you're taking on a power block that can now influence the Vatican.
Yeah,
you see, so now the CIA has a huge amount of say. So
yeah, there's a documentary called John Paul II and Communism, and it really shows how John Paul II and Reagan take down communism in the 80s, and it's like
that's the point of the Kaler book. Yeah.
And it makes it look like this great thing, which I mean, you got to take down communism, but
the problem is that now you have a new master. That's the point. That's Wim Hof's point in his book, is that it's not that communism's good, but that when this alliance between the Vatican and the CIA happens, this leads to a lot of problems with now the power block that runs the CIA has like families like the Rockefeller, right? They're having a say so in terms of like, hey, Vatican, we're ready for you to start caving on Skittles stuff. We're ready for you to start caving on this thing. That's the push pull that they get. See what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm not just singling out the Vatican, because the same thing happened with the Ecumenical Patriarch. It's identical operation.
Yeah.
They did the
exact same. I saw just even one of the, I don't know who it was, the American bishop of even the Orthodox Church. This is affecting everybody. That's the thing. It's like, and even the Orthodox have to understand that what happens to Rome happens in the West. I mean, it's just, there's a reason why they want Rome to cave on these issues so bad, is because as the church goes, so goes the world. And that's, regardless of your position on what the Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodoxy is,
that's true.
The reality of it. Like they're the only block of Christianity big enough to actually still have sway over things. So it's the same thing with Francis when he took the position he did on the shot in 2020, him endorsing that made it impossible for people to go and put a religious exemption in. I mean, it was, I actually had Con Edison telling me, no, we won't accept your religious exemption based on things that your Pope said. And I had to get an individual priest to actually sign my exemption letter. And I was able to get my exemption because an individual priest did. But like, I was this close to losing my job, dude. And it was because the Vatican took that position on that.
Dang, it's crazy. Dude, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, we had individual bishops in the Orthodox Church posing the same problem. So yeah, I understand. I can empathize. That's crazy. And by the way, I would add too that like Wim Hof's book, he's a lawyer. And as far as I know, I think he just attends the traditional Latin mass. He's not a conspiracy theorist. He's just a lawyer who wrote a giant 800 page book about the history of what's called the doctrinal warfare program. That's the CIA's doctrinal warfare program during the Cold War to make the, and it's, you're absolutely right. It's not just the Roman Catholic Church, but it forms the sort of paradigm example of what you're talking about. If they could get the Vatican as an engine of Americanism and a tool of soft power, then the rest they believed would follow. The Orthodox would also become a tool of Americanism. And then the Protestant churches were already sort of, you know, controlled a long time
ago. Well, they're just, especially the American Protestant church, they are just, like, they have such a hard time distinguishing between being a Christian and being a Republican. Like, that's, it's such a
real problem. Well, the mainline Protestants were, like, they caved to liberalism in the 20s and 30s. That's how long ago they were. They were already, I mean, the word fundamentalism in American Christianity, it comes from Protestants who were reacting in like the 20s and 30s to the mainline Protestant denominations caving at that time.
Yeah.
So the mainline Lutherans, the mainline Methodists, Episcopals, they were already going liberal in the 20s, 30s, 40s. That's where fundamentalism comes from, is a reaction to that. That's why the PCUSA has, you know, like women bishops and you know, this kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's like almost an idolatry of politics in certain branches of Protestantism. You see, you'll even have guys call themselves MAGA pastors, things like that. It's really strange, you know.
MAGA rappers. What that is?
Before we get off, you got to tell me what toll houses are, because I had Christian Mario on, and we were talking about like purgatory, and he was like, he's like, I'm not suited to explain it, but I'm like, what the hell are toll houses? I don't even know what the hell they are. What are toll houses?
Right. So, you know, in the Orthodox view, that there's a lot of stuff that's not defined. Like you were saying earlier, like not everything has like, do we believe this? Oh, well, let's go look in this book to see if there's like, is it part of the list of the things that I have to believe? And I mean, really, Roman Catholicism also doesn't necessarily, I mean, you got Denzinger and you've got the Catechism and stuff like that, but even that's not the extent of like everything you have to believe. But so basically, it's just the idea that is more of a liturgical, mystical view, that tradition that when the body dies, the soul has to sort of go through an ascent back to God. So it's not purgatory because you're not like paying off debts, but there is a sort of mystical notion of.
Would that be kind of like Dante? Like doesn't he have to go down before he comes up? And Dante's. I never read it. I remember trying to read it, and it was just too difficult. But
I've read it. I mean, he goes to you know, he does Purgatio, Inferno, and then he, you know, heaven. But no, this is more like there's angelic beings that are sort of arranged in a hierarchy that you ascend back to God through, so to speak. So it's like there's spiritual gateways. Seraphim Rose has a book called Life of the Soul After Death. So even though we don't believe in purgatory, we do have a period where when you die, where you're apart from the body, there is this. There's a time period, for example, where there's a tradition, it's not dogma, that the soul is still around for a while. And this is why, for example, we pray for the dead. We do think that those that die in the church, that the prayers for the dead help them. And then the soul has to sort of return, but the return, there's a sort of journey. So it's not, this is a bad analogy, but have you ever heard of that book? Is it like the Tibetan Book of the Dead?
I've heard of it.
I mean, that's obviously pagan, and you in you, but the idea is kind of similar, where in that, when you die, you kind of go through these, for them it's demons, because they're basically going into, I think, into a hellish existence where you're sort of walking through these demon gates. But in the Orthodox tradition is sort of ascending through angelic gates. So the celestial hierarchy is involved in the afterlife is the point.
I like to think the first domino in getting Jay in Roman Catholic discourse to be a thing. Oh, he was. He went on your show. That's Joe Boca.
Oh, yeah.
It was you, Joe, and Christian Mario. You guys did a show together.
I was wondering what happened to... Because he left Twitter, so we used to
DM. He's still on there. He's just hiding from everybody. He's got a lot of account, you know. And okay.
He disappeared, so.
He was basically chased off by a bunch of witches. let's call him a coven of witches.
Literal feminist witches, or are you joking?
Yeah, well, not literal witches, but they were just a coven of feminists.
Oh, like
he just got bombarded, and he was like, you know, banshees. I don't even want to deal with this.
A bunch of banshees.
So he dipped, and then he just came back like recently, but he's still keeping his account locked and stuff like that. But somebody asked why you think Fatima is a conspiracy.
In my opinion, I wrote a couple articles on this a long time ago, just outlining that, you know, I don't want to make you guys all mad. I guess think I'm here to like rile up everybody, but
that's Anthony riles people up.
When I got into the geopolitical side of things, it gave me a new angle on some of these events. And I'm not saying every event God can do what God wants to do. I'm not trying to say that there's no miracles or anything like that. But it seems to me that it's much more sensible from a geopolitical perspective, in terms of, if you read Quigley, what the Anglo-American establishment prior to World War I, what they wanted to do. In terms of targeting the opponents of the Anglo Empire, American Empire, Israel doesn't exist yet, but their two main rivals are the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is Catholic, and Russia, which is Orthodox. So they strategize different ways to rile up people, and they had a cognizance at that time, even in terms of psychological warfare, of ways to marshal large numbers of people. So fast forward to Cold War, there's multiple examples in CIA manuals, CIA history books. I just read Graziano's academic. These are academic texts, by the way, not conspiracy books. Graziano put out a book. He's an academic. The History of the CIA and Religion. And it's not, you know, obviously it's the last several decades, so it's not all time in terms of intelligence, but just the CIA's relationship. If you look at people like Ed Lansdale, in multiple cases, he was staging Marian apparitions, staging things to dupe Catholics. He even went so far as to propose to the CIA a staged second coming. I mean, these people are crazy, to dupe Roman Catholics in Cuba. So Michael EMJ talks about his belief that, I think he thinks Medjugorje is
Medjugorje. Yeah, that's his whole.
Yeah. So I was surprised to see him saying that. I went pretty deep into Bayside. I read an academic guy's analysis of Bayside. I think Bayside's super duper weird. That's
right near me. That's like a half hour from my house. I don't know anything about it. What's going on? But I know it sounds super sketchy though.
You gotta read this paper, dude. They were saying crazy. They were talking SATA stuff before anybody else. Isn't that weird?
Oh man, I wanna learn about this. All I've heard is that it's super sketchy, the Bayside one. I don't know anything about it.
The thing about Bayside is that she made a bunch of predictions about America getting nuked, getting destroyed, the Soviets were going to invade. It was just Cold War propaganda.
Yeah.
Totally. And then when that stuff didn't happen, oh, well, you know, Mary has decided not to do it.
Our prayers averted the disaster.
Exactly. Yeah. So my thesis is that it seems like Fatima serves the British imperial designs for World War One and World War Two. Eventually, I mean, Fatima's not part of World War Two, but I'm saying World War One is a big part of that. And I've always found it odd that, like, first of all, Russia's errors, communism would come from Russia. Communism comes from England. Marx and Engels are in England. And Marxism, socialism, I mean, they're English, and I'm sure you guys can figure out who else, right?
Amish.
Right? The Irish, the Amish. Amish, right. Amish and English.
Yeah.
That's where Marx, it doesn't come out of Russia. So it's odd that Mary identifies Russia, who is particularly the enemy of the Anglo-American Empire. So I've always found it odd to me. I think she would say, if it was a true apparition, she would say, you know, England's errors will spread to Russia and then infect the world or something like that. So anyway, I just think that makes more
sense. Well, you also even have to think the shadiness with the Third Secret and stuff. Like there's all this mystery surrounding Fatima. So I know a lot of Catholics treat Fatima as if it's like a fifth gospel. Like Fatima converted me though. So it's weird that the shadiness about it. I do think
you mean like the stories of the miracle of the sun or something, or what do you mean?
I was away from the faith for years, and I stumbled across a Fatima documentary, and I had an illumination of conscience through it that like blew me away. And
the one that just Ricardo Montalban is the narrator. Is it that one?
I don't know who it was. I remember
watching one with him as the moderator or the
Yeah, I don't remember what I'd have to find the documentary, but it just like I had this illumination of God. I just saw myself like burning in hell. It was pretty intense, and it like led to me coming back to the faith and coming back to church and changing my whole life around and stuff. So like I do have an attachment to Fatima, but there's also a lot of shady stuff that goes on. And you're also it's another one of those things where everyone's always talking about the Third Secret is going to be fulfilled. The Third Secret is going to be fulfilled. I mean, you had guys who were telling us it was going to be fulfilled any day who are now dead. You know, you've been waiting. It was like in 1960, the secret will be revealed, and it wasn't revealed. And then this, you know, there's a whole lot of things that go on. So there's always going to be that veil of mystery to the whole thing that obviously so an agency like the CIA would use to manipulate people, things like that. So,
well, now we know for sure they have, right? Because there have been multiple cases where Ed Lansdale is on record trying to do it and doing it. Not every case it was successful. Victor Marchetti in his CIA memoirs talks about staging Marian stuff in Latin South America against the communists. And it's like, well, but we got to do what we got to do against the communists. Okay. But wait a minute. Like now we're staging, like, I'm not saying communists are good, but like that, it calls into question a lot of things when, you know what I mean? When I would just say, you got to read this Bayside paper and you'll see what I'm getting at.
Yeah. I want to read that one, 'cause I've heard a lot of shady, strange things about Bayside, and it's one that's so close to my house that I don't even,
Is that still going on? Like, do people still,
I don't know. I've heard from people that like in my area about Bayside, they're like, nah, don't even look into that one. That one's a little shady. So I might look it up.
I remember I had a trad cat friend that got really into, back in the day, maybe just like maybe 10, 15 years ago, the Great Chastisement and like the 3 days of darkness or some nonsense.
Yeah. The 3 days of darkness stuff. Like I consider that like the Catholic rapture. Like these are people that think if they have beeswax candles, they're going to escape some kind of chastisement. And it's like, dude, that is,
where, that does is that come rapture. Out of Bayside or Medjugorje? What's that?
That's Mary Taiji. That's a few older mystics. That's
the other one. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, but it seems like one of those things where it's you know, if you have blessed beeswax candles, you're not going to be able to open your windows. You have to make sure you have tape for your windows, and it's almost counterintuitive to what the faith teaches, which is more like, okay, you embrace your suffering and unite it to the cross.
Yeah,
you don't try and hide from it with magic candles.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah. You know, Mary Julie Jahini. Okay, yeah, that's a different one. Let me tell you this. Let me tell you this Bayside paper. And now this guy's an academic who's just writing about how Bayside was used in the Cold War. He's not like a conspiracy person, and he's not, you know, interested in whether Catholicism is true or not. But I'll give you this. It's a really fascinating paper that I think makes. It's called "The Virgin and the Bomb: The Bayside Apparitions, Cold War Anxieties, and Marian Anti-Communism," is the name of the paper. So I recommend that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out. the wait, what was somebody just saying in here? Yeah, dude, like, and if you guys think like we're saying something bad about Fatima, it's like, you think about even the conspiracies about like a fake sister Lucy and stuff.
Yeah, I remember
and,
that. Yeah,
like, all right, so we were, you were talking earlier, you were like, even with the stuff we started the show with, like, people are so jaded from being lied to by the government that they go down these conspiracy rabbit holes. Right. Like, how do you know when to cut that off? Like, how do you, because you hear the craziest, even during COVID, when the medicine was coming out, you heard these things where people like they're making plans that in 3 years, everybody's going to die. And it's like, all right, I'm so glad I didn't get that thing. But there's also, yeah, you know, things were obviously exaggerated and stuff. Like, how do you even know when to put a barrier up and go, all right, that's too far from
me? That's a good question. There's no easy answer to that. I mean, I've been looking at conspiracies since like 1998 was my first foray into that world. I think after over time, you kind of get used to the patterns of the things that are baloney. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of the really wild stuff is baloney. Sometimes wild things do happen, right? But it's like the really wild stuff is every 10 or 20 years, right? I mean, how often do we get a big nine event or a big coup event, right? Like, yeah, it's not a lot, but the wilder stuff usually is not the case. But yeah, it's a great question. There's not any easy answers. I do think that it helps to have, I'll say this, there's two fallacies that conspiracy theorists always fall into, gambler's fallacy and the Texas sharpshooter fallacy. And basically, like, you know, gambler's fallacy is where if I roll a dice five times in a row and it lands on three, is there any necessary connection between the five times I rolled three that the next time will be a three? No.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no
connection at all. It's just chance. Right.
Exactly. So there's no, the fact that, you know, an event, you know, let's say three events are sus, and then a fourth event happens that's very much like the previous three events. Does that necessarily mean that the fourth event is a fake flag or sus? Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Many conspiracy theorists will default, right, to, oh, it has to be because of these, and that's a fallacy. So you have to be careful with that. The other fallacy is a Texas sharpshooter, where the data is picked to fit the preconceived notion.
Yeah.
And any data that doesn't fit the narrative is excluded, right? And that's another one, obviously, that, you know, conspiracy people can fall into. So I think one, or those, keeping that in mind is a helpful way to avoid falling forward.
I fall into it sometimes where I just, like, any stupid news story that comes out, I'm like, I just don't, they got me to the point where I just don't trust anything anymore.
Well, that's natural, right? I mean, if you've been lied to by the establishment a million zillion times, then I think it's the natural reaction to be to doubt it. But, you know, when we do try to give an analysis and have a narrative explanation for this or that thing, we just have to be careful as conspiracy-minded people to not fall into those two fallacies.
What do you got going on with Jamie Kennedy? What's that whole thing? You guys are doing shows together?
Yeah, man. I'm trying to remember how that came about. I remember going to Sam Tripoli's show, like, the first time in person. I went to L.A. in 2018, and we did some events out there. And there was a girl comedian on Tripoli's show with me, and I gave her my book. And she just happened to be friends with Jamie Kennedy. I didn't know that. And so Jamie had gotten my book a long time ago, and I had no idea. And then I remember I saw him on Tripoli's show, and I messaged him, and I didn't think he would do anything. I didn't think he would come on the show. I was just like, hey, you want to come on my podcast? You know, I've grew up watching you and watching your shows, and I thought you're, you know, super funny dude. And he was like, yeah, dude, let's do a show. So we did a podcast. We got along pretty good. And then he was like, I don't even remember how we came up with the idea to do a live show. I think he suggested, he's like, yeah, come on, when you come out to LA, let's do like a live event. And the first one went really good. And then we went back out to LA a month or two ago and did our second LA event with him. And it was really good. So then he's like, he took us out to dinner and we were eating at a Korean barbecue in LA. And he was like, I think we need to do this. And they do it again. It's to Vegas, right? So now we're going to do a Vegas event. It's going to be fun. And then I just got to go do the Sam Hyde podcast, which was wild. So,
yeah, dude, you pop crazy up in the funniest places, man. It's like I saw you. You shot like you challenged Ruslan to come on or something. He's like, only if you come in person. I'll do it if you come in person.
He hasn't seen the videos where I was like responding. So he mentioned having a rap battle, and I was like, "Yeah, let's do it." But then he watched my responses, and I think it made him mad. So now he won't reply. He's ghosting me now. So
because okay, so I watched your Ruslan response videos, and they're so funny because you point out where he's just playing a Gavin Ortlund video.
Yeah,
and he'll play a clip, and he'll go. Like you're not actually saying anything there, dude. You're just
like 20 minutes of video of him going,
look at that point that didn't actually connect to anything at all. You know, I like Ruslan when he does like cultural commentary, but then when he starts getting into biblical stuff, I'm just like, dude, what are you like? It's just so incoherent. Like
Yeah,
I don't know. I have like almost no patience for Protestant argument at this point.
I love to like if he's not mad, I'll go out there and debate on his podcast. But I feel like now he's mad, he won't have me on. I don't know, but I'll do it if he wants.
Yeah, you will go at anybody, man. It's pretty funny. all right, man. We'll wrap this up, dude. Thanks for coming on, man. You always come on when we ask. We always have a good time with you. Wait, before we go,
yeah,
what do you think of Dune?
I loved it. There's a couple places I would critique it, but I think I did like three podcasts on I read Doom Messiah like a couple months ago and did a whole podcast on that before it came out. I'm about to read Children of Dune. So, I liked it. I thought it was the first time I've enjoyed going to the theater in a long time.
Since the Matrix, I think, like that was the last time I felt like that.
Lord of the Rings. Was
Lord of the Rings or the Matrix or something. Yeah. Did you perceive Paul as a false messiah? Because that's the narrative that everybody was given. And I'm like, he wasn't a false messiah. He was like the messiah the Jews wanted. He was like the messiah the Jews wanted to conquer the world in the name of Israel, you know?
Well, and the whole storyline, it turns out he is and he isn't. So he kind of is a savior in immediate sense, to go back to our earlier, because he gives birth to Leto the Second, who actually does end up being the Lison Al-Gaith. So he's kind of like the conduit for the.
I'm wondering what they're going to do with the next movie, because I kind of want them to pick up right where they left off with that war. But if they do the Dune Messiah, it's like 15 years later or something, right?
Have you read it?
No. We had our friend Mark on, and he told us the whole lore.
It's crazy, dude. Like, Dune Messiah is very different from Dune. It's like it's all like courtly intrigue and conspiracy versus like Dune is an action movie. You know, it's an epic sort of battle, but Dune Messiah is like a conspiracy philosophy book. It's very different. So it will be weird to see how they play that out.
Yeah, I love watching your breakdowns of movies and things like that, and just even some of the Jordan Peterson stuff you've done. Those are the things I enjoy the most that you do. So,
thank you.
But all right, thanks for coming on, Jay. You got anything to
promote? Could I remind everybody too that if they do want to come out to see our event, it's not primarily a theologically focused event, although there might be Q&A. People can ask questions if they want to. Our live events are 6 hours, so there's like lectures on the stuff that you just said you like, right? So we do a lot of deep dives into symbolism, esoteric stuff, movie analysis, geopolitics. Mm-hmm. I talk about all of that in my live talks. We have some stand-ups, some comedy, and then Jamie Kennedy as well. So it's not a theologically driven. It's just kind of everything. If you guys want to come out,
June 23rd, you're kind of like a jack of all trades, man. You know how to fit in. Like even when you were on Tim Pool, like you know how to not corner yourself into one specific topic. You're very good at just being like you throw me in the mix and I'll freaking talk about anything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like all of us, I'm sure that, you know, we all have different interests. I like different. I get bored if you just talk about, you know, just talk about movies all the time. That'd be boring.
Yeah. Yeah, dude, even us, like having you on is to put some variety in. Like people, mm-hmm. like how many times are you going to talk about the same issues over and over? It's like, to me, it's fun to get somebody from a totally different perspective. It doesn't have to be a freaking totally Catholic focused show. We could just talk about faith in general.
Yeah.
Transhumanism, whatever. It's just to put a little mix into the subject matter. Absolutely. A lot of people, who knows what people like, you know? So, but yeah, dude, thank you so much, Jay. Anything else you want to promote? It's just the Vegas show.
No, June 22nd in Vegas. Go ahead and get your tickets early. And I got some big shows coming up. So you'll see me on some of those in the next couple months. Hopefully there might be a couple really big ones. So,
and go check out Jay's videos disputing Protestantism, man. They're some of the best. They really are hilarious.
Thank you.
Just point out like the absurdity of some of the arguments. Watch that. If you guys watch any of the Ruslan like takedowns, they're freaking amazing. So
thank you. All right,
Jay, thank you, brother. We will see you
next guys. Time. All right, have a good night.
Yeah. Later.